You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
ISIS has held Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city, for nearly 3 years now. As the Iraqi military readies for a final push to oust them, there's great concern about what may follow. Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi needs to reassure all Iraqis that they'll be included in a unified federal Iraq, but that won't be easy in light of allegations that Shia militias have been abducting and abusing Sunni Muslim civilians. Ramita Navai joins us now to discuss her latest report for Frontline and what she found in areas where ISIS has been pushed out. The documentary Iraq Uncovered premieres tonight on PBS and online at 10 p.m., and I'm very pleased it has brought Ramita Navai to our show. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You've been reporting on conflicts in the Middle East for 11 years. How are you able to get into these war-torn countries like Syria and Iraq?
Well, I guess I've got a little advantage in that I can maneuver kind of unnoticed because I am originally Iranian. I was born in Iran. So with a headscarf and a abaya, the kind of all-encompassing black robe, I can pass as a local pretty easily.
The film begins with you preparing to go into dangerous areas in Iraq with no real protection, and I couldn't help wondering about your safety throughout the report. Every time there's a sign of danger, you actually travel toward it. Haven't Iraqi journalists been killed trying to tell this story?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I am very careful, and I'm very careful when it comes to risks and keeping everybody around me safe. The Iraqi journalists that were killed, rather shockingly, they had been embedded with an Iraqi general from the army. And as they were leaving him, that's when they got intercepted by Shia militia. And they were killed. Their camera was destroyed. So we decided to go very low profile. I went in with my Iraqi producer, Mace. We decided it wasn't safe for our director, Paddy, who's very tall and blonde, to come in with us. And we were taken in, actually, by two Shia guides. And it's really important to point out that they're Shias, because they wanted to expose what the Shia militia were doing in their province, because they're so upset at what's happening to their Sunni neighbors.
The images from the beginning of the film are of you traveling through northern Iraq, and it looks absolutely devastated. Who did all the bombing of homes and buildings in that region?
Do you know what? It's not just northern Iraq. This really struck me. We traveled the length and breadth of the country, and it is in ruins. We saw those images everywhere, mountains of rubble and destruction. And this is from airstrikes and from fighting between the Iraqi army and ISIS and the Shia militia.
And one town you point out is Baiji. It used to have 200,000 inhabitants before ISIS took over. What's happened to its residents since ISIS is no longer there? Have people begun to return?
There have been some returnees, but we went through village upon village, town upon town, nearly completely abandoned because there's nowhere to live. And if houses are still standing, ISIS booby-trapped them. So it's too dangerous to return until they're all checked and they're all cleared. So much of Iraq lies abandoned towns and villages. And there are over 3 million displaced people, 3 million people who have nowhere to live or are living in refugee camps or are on the move or living with family.
And no aid for them to rebuild?
The rebuilding is slow, and as I've seen in so many countries with rebuilding and with aid money, the aid money, first of all, always trickles in. You know, there may be big announcements that the country or the UN is donating X million dollars, but it doesn't come immediately. It trickles in, and rebuilding is always slow. And this is, you know, a long, many, many years of war now. It is going to take a long time to rebuild that country. And it was, even our producer, Mace, driving around, you know, she spoke about feeling a deep sadness and of feeling pretty hopeless that her country was so ruined.
Many countries are engaged in the war against ISIS, or Daesh, as it's called locally. But you found many Iraqi Sunnis are most afraid of the militias. Haven't the Shia militias been a crucial part of Iraq's fight against ISIS?
They have. And we mustn't forget that really it's largely thanks to the Shia militias that ISIS didn't take more territory, didn't get more power, didn't overrun Baghdad. Because as you remember, what happened when ISIS kind of thundered across Iraq is that the Iraqi army dropped their weapons and ran. They fled. And that's when these Shia militias, this latest incarnation of the Shia militias, were formed. Ordinary guys, brave men, joined up the Shia militias to fight back ISIS. And we met many of these Shia militias who said they were doing it for Sunnis and Shias alike. And these Shia militias, because of that, are seen as absolute heroes by many. But what this war has enabled different groups to do is to take full opportunity and is to grab territory and power. We've seen this with the Kurds. The Kurds have expanded their territory by some 30%, I think it is. And the Shia militias have also encroaching on Sunni territory. However, worse than that, revenge. And revenge has come in the form of mass arrests, mass imprisonment, abductions, and even killings of Sunni civilians. And it's taken a rather frightening turn in provinces like Diyala that we mentioned, gangsterism. So you get Sunni militia groups that are now kidnapping civilians for ransom in order to make money.
Well, let's talk about that revenge for a moment. ISIS follows its own version of Sunni Islam. So is this a matter of guilt by association, where all Sunni refugees might be seen as suspect by the Shia militia? And how much of this is a form of payback? Shiites make up 60% of the Iraqi population, but they were oppressed during all the years that Saddam Hussein was in power.
Absolutely. Both of those things. Revenge and, you know, by association, all Sunnis are being tarred with the same brush. So many militiamen I spoke to, you know, off camera, they'd say, you know, anybody from Fallujah is ISIS. How do you think ISIS managed to stay there? Anybody from Hawija is ISIS. Even if they're not a fighter, they are ISIS. They're Sunnis. Of course, you speak to people who have fled places like Hawija and places like Fallujah when it was under ISIS. And you hear a very different picture. And these are Sunnis who feel totally trapped between a rock and a hard place. They were fleeing ISIS. Life was horrific under ISIS. They have witnessed terrible things. And now they're as scared of the militias, if not more scared. They've had to flee. They've had loved ones imprisoned, tortured, and they've been warned by the militias never to return to their homes. And we met so many Sunnis in this position in refugee camps in Diyala who had fled Diyala. And your second point is absolutely true as well. We spoke to Shia militiamen that said, it's payback time. We suffered. We're now in charge.
I'm speaking with Ramila Navai, whose latest report is Iraq Uncovered, which premieres tonight on PBS and online at 10 p.m. as part of the Frontline series. Previous reports include Undercover Syria, which won a number of awards, Egypt, Sex, Mobs, and Revolution. She's also the author of City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death, and the Search for Truth in Tehran. How many Shiite militias are there? You mostly talk about the two big ones, Hezbollah, which I'm assuming is some way associated with the Hezbollah of Lebanon, and the Badr militia.
Kataib Hezbollah actually are the most secretive of the militia. They are funded by Iran, supported by Iran. Badr also have close links to Iran. Regarding figures, estimates vary quite wildly, but there are about 40 different Shia militia groups, and anything from 40 to 100,000 fighters. The numbers are always changing, but there are many of them, and they're powerful.
And what do the Shia militias say they want for their country? Does it vary from group to group?
Yeah, and also it depends if there's a camera on them or not. although I must admit that I spoke to many genuine young men who really did believe that they're fighting for the rights of both Sunnis and Shias. But, you know, many men, when the cameras are rolling, will tell you, we're fighting for a unified Iraq, and as soon as ISIS are beaten, we're going to put down our weapons and go home. And then, of course, a different picture emerges when you catch them talking among themselves, and in their more honest moments, that they now feel empowered. They don't want to put down their weapons. And this is the big question. What is going to happen to these tens of thousands of fighters, of armed men? Well, in November last year, they were officially recognized by the government, and now they officially answer to the Prime Minister. So they've been incorporated into government. And the question now is, what happens after Mosul? Will they then be incorporated into the army? Will many be laid off? And these are questions that remain unanswered.
Do they work in cooperation with the army?
Sometimes they have to. Certainly men we spoke to in the Golden Division, which is the elite division of the army when we were in Mosul, trained by the Americans, were very frank with us and told us that they did not like having anything to do with the Shia militia. They saw them as deeply sectarian, whereas the Golden Division prides itself on being non-sectarian. And there are also questions regarding Mosul about the Shia militia and its role in Mosul right now. Of course, the Americans and Prime Minister Abadi assured Iraqis that the Shia militia would not be entering Mosul, but the Shia militia now are on the outskirts of the city, and everyone is kind of watching what the next step will be, what happens next.
Toward the end of your journey, you met with an Iranian-sponsored militia group. Who was leading that group? And he said that without the support of Iran, there is no way that they could have come this far in the fight against ISIS.
Yeah, that was quite extraordinary. Shia militia leaders, very secretive when it comes to Iranian support, and he was very open with us. The leader, Abu Ala al-Wa'eli, said in no uncertain terms that it's because of Iran that his group have been armed and have been trained to the standard that they have been, that they have the power that they do. He also said that his men are fighting for Assad with Iranians in Syria. And this is really extraordinary for him to admit how much patronage he does get from Iran, and also to admit that he doesn't follow Iraq's spiritual leader, Shia spiritual leader, but Iran's spiritual leader. And this really does tell you how closely involved Iran is with Iraq, but also Iran's regional ambitions and the regional ambitions of the Shia militia. They see themselves now as protectors of Shia rights within the whole region, not simply with Iraq. They definitely have an eye on the region, and they're looking to expand.
But Assad is not a Shiite. Do they see the fight in Syria and Iraq as being pretty much the same thing?
Well, they see Assad as one of their own, because even though he's not a Shia, he's an Alawite, which is kind of an offshoot of Shia Islam. And for them, strategically, it's really important that they have an Alawite, a Shia sympathizer in power. Gosh, I'm sorry, my phone has started talking all on its own. strategically, it's really important because they see Syria as a gateway passing from Tehran through Iraq all the way to Syria, to Hezbollah in Lebanon. In Lebanon, and that gives them some kind of protection against Israel. And it's a counterbalance to Israel to be able to pump weapons across this corridor from Tehran all the way through Lebanon, through Syria, to Hezbollah there. That's why it's of utmost importance, and that's why it's of utmost importance to keep Assad and an Alawite in power in Syria.
Ramita, we're going to take a little break here. So you could probably go to your phone for a moment, but it won't be long. I'm speaking with Ramita Navai, whose report for Frontline is called Iraq Uncovered. It premieres tonight on PBS and online at 10 p.m. Stay with us for more. We're back with Ramita Navaid to talk about her latest report for Frontline. It is Iraq Uncovered, premieres tonight on PBS and online at 10 p.m. You traveled to Al-Fatah in northern Iraq to meet with a concerned militia fighter. Was he putting his life on the line by simply talking with you?
When we went to Diyala, is this when we went undercover and we met the militiaman who gave us a tour? Mm-hmm. Yes, he was putting his life on the line. If he'd have been caught, he told us that he would have been absolutely killed. And he was really disillusioned with what the militia had become. He was one of the guys that joined up early on because he wanted to protect his country and he wanted to fight ISIS. But being from Diyala province, of course, Diyala province was mixed. It's a Sunni-Shia province. You get some provinces that are entirely Sunni or entirely Shia, but Diyala has historically been mixed. So he grew up with Sunnis, and he didn't equate ISIS with his Sunni neighbors. He saw ISIS, as many Sunnis see ISIS, as simply a death cult, not a religious group at all. And then after the fighting, and he still fights every now and again, goes to the front line. But being in Diyala, he saw the militia start to morph into what he termed himself as a group of gangsters. He saw his colleagues starting to kidnap ordinary Sunnis. And he's from a small town, so you know each other, you know your neighbors. And so soon enough, he would learn that people he knew were being kidnapped, and some of these people were being killed, and they were being held for ransom. And it took a long while to gain his trust. He came through trusted contacts of ours. He was really, really scared to talk to us. And we met him, and he opened up pretty fast because he realized that we were going to stick to our word, that we were absolutely going to protect him, that we're going to change his voice, we were not going to film his face. And that's when he really opened up and he gave us a tour of a kind of militia abuses tour of where he was from.
And you speak to a number of people whose faces we don't see and whose voices have been altered. I guess a lot of people felt that was a necessity. Joe Biden, many years ago, I think when he was running for president, suggested that Iraq be split up into a number of different countries. Do you think that would have been a good solution?
I don't think that's what many Iraqis want. I did actually ask many Iraqis that I met, so is this the answer? Kurds in the north, Sunnistan and a Shiistan, the Shiistan to the east, Sunnis to the west. Kurdistan to the north. And the Kurdistan has happened. But Iraqis really, even now, where Sunnis and Shias are in absolute turmoil over the growing sectarian divide, even now there are very strong voices against that, against a split. And of course, you know, geographically speaking, a split would not be good for Sunnis. They'd get the desert. They really wouldn't get much. They wouldn't be able to survive. So they're in this very tricky, terrible position of relying on a unified Iraq for their own survival, in a way, without sounding dramatic. And I think that really is the key. And if we look really deep, this is why we get Sunni insurgencies, because you have the Sunni community who are disenfranchised, who feel so disempowered, who feel that they've lost everything.
And do you report on Sunni farms being burned to the ground? I was thinking, who's growing the food that both Sunnis and Shiites have to eat?
Yeah, well, we heard many reports of Sunni farms being burnt to the ground. But these weren't necessarily farms that are providing food for the whole country. What we were seeing, especially in Diyala province, was sectarian cleansing. So you burn a Sunni farm, you kidnap Sunni members of a community, and the whole community flees. You burn a Sunni farm, and all the neighbors flee. And so the demographics of Diyala province are really starting to change. And what's happening when these Sunnis are fleeing and they're ending up in refugee camps in the north of the province, in Diyala province now, which, incidentally, since the war began, has been taken over by the Kurds, what you're seeing is that these Sunni civilians who have fled will tell you that they are too scared to go back. We mentioned this before. Because of the militias, they're terrified.
In fact, in the middle of a battlefield near Al-Fatah, you spotted Sunni families that were fleeing ISIS-held territory. The militias picked them up, and all the males under 70 were separated from their families because they were all suspect. They were all suspected of being supporters of ISIS?
Yes, anybody fleeing from ISIS territory is treated with absolute suspicion. On one hand, you can understand it because there have been so many incidents of ISIS fighters hiding among refugees and of attacks. This is when attacks happen, when people blow themselves up when they're among refugees and they come to checkpoints or they're met by the army or the militia. But on the other hand, when we spoke to these people who'd fled, they'd endured 18 hours on foot being shot at by ISIS. A horrific journey. They'd endured 2 years of living under ISIS and witnessing terrible things. And now, of course, it wasn't over. Now they lived in fear that maybe their name was on a list, maybe their name was erroneously on a list. What did this list mean? So they were all taken away. And this is when they're scooped up. This is when also the militia take full advantage and is scooping them up. We were taken to a militia prison, not a legal prison. It was an abandoned house. And we were taken there by militiamen who said to us, listen, we have nothing to hide. Because the men, they didn't look like they'd been tortured and beaten in this prison. It was pretty packed. The men looked terrified. But of course, under Iraqi law, they're meant to be prisoners are meant to be transferred to the government swiftly, pretty quickly. And by their own admission, militiamen told us, yeah, we've been holding these guys for over 3 months. We're not going to let them go until we're sure they're not ISIS.
Now, they weren't tortured, but in other situations, you found people who had been killed and tortured and then killed. So it varies from, I guess, from militia to militia and camp to camp. Why doesn't the Iraqi government step in and take care of these refugees? Isn't there concern that there'll be a great deal of mistrust and possibly another civil war in Iraq after ISIS is defeated if something isn't done to stop the Shia militia from mistreating the Sunni refugees?
Absolutely. And this really tells you how powerful some of the Shia militia groups really are. So the government knows that there's a network of prisons run by Kataib Hezbollah, the militia we were speaking about that is one of the most powerful, one of the most secretive, backed by Iran. The government knows, has been told, there's a list of over 2,000 names of Sunni men who are being held in this prison. We met many Sunni MPs who told us that they'd been lobbying the government, calling on the government to call an investigation to release these men. About 50, 60 of these men have been released. Nobody really knows why they were released. And I spoke to two of them, and they had been horrifically tortured, beaten with electric wires and cables. And both of them had witnessed people being killed in this prison. And even the vice president, Ayad Alawi, who was a Shia, he told me there won't be any investigation. The government may say they'll investigate, but they won't really investigate. This is what the vice president told me. And he said, because they've got people in government, they've got people in power, they're very powerful. And what he means by that is that there are many people in parliament, in government, in positions of power, who are closely allied to the militia, who either have links with the militia or who are members of different militia groups. And this is what people fear, is warlordism, that you'll get politicians with their own private militias, or politicians who work with militias funded by Iran. And what we're seeing is that they're actually starting to compete among themselves.
Although he kind of suggested that many of the incidents were isolated, personal things, he dismissed some of them. When you spoke to the Sunni politicians, were they putting their lives in danger?
Well, actually, you know, Iyad Alawi, the vice president, didn't dismiss.
Oh, it was another. It was one of the rare other Shiite politicians, because most of them ignored your request for an interview, I'm assuming, because they were just dodging uncomfortable questions.
Absolutely. And actually, the person who did dismiss it was a militia spokesperson. He was the political advisor to a man called Hadi al-Amari, who is the head of the Badr organization, which is Iraq's biggest militia. And as we expected, he was the guy that said, you know what, a few bad apples, and this is a war. And I don't believe that real, true militia members are actually doing what you say that they're doing. But I guess that was to be expected.
I'm speaking with Ramita Navai, whose latest report for Frontline is called Iraq Uncovered. It premieres tonight on PBS and online at 10 p.m. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You visited a number of refugee camps where women and children, for example, in Saqlawiya were staying. It had been 4 months since they had seen their husbands, sons, the other males in their families. Do you know if they ever saw them again?
No. These men are still missing, and we're talking about 643 men that have been documented that were last seen being taken off into the desert by Shia militia groups, and they have not been seen since. And this is one incident of many. We decided to tell the story of these men from Saqlawiya who've gone missing. There are survivors of the Saqlawiya incident. So originally the Shia militia had taken about 1,300 to 400 men, imprisoned them, then taken this 600-odd number out into the desert, never to be seen again. The men who were released from prison, they were tortured as well. And there's quite shocking testimony of how they were treated. And it comes back to revenge and being tarred by the same brush and being caught in the crossfire between ISIS and fighting with the army and the militia.
What are the human rights groups in Iraq able to do, aside from documenting these alleged abuses?
Well, human rights groups in Iraq have a very hard time, as you can imagine. There are international human rights groups that work with individuals. So there's Amnesty, there's Human Rights Watch, and they do fantastic work. But even for them, it's really hard to get into all of the areas of Iraq to get this testimony. But Iraqi human rights groups live in fear. And there are many incidents, as there are of Iraqi journalists, of them being killed and of them being imprisoned. People are very scared to talk out against the militia in Iraq.
And what do former prisoners tell you? The Hezbollah brigade is running a prison in Jerf al-Sahar, and you were able to interview a former prisoner. First of all, how do you find these people? And under what conditions did he agree to talk to you? And what did he tell you he was told after he'd been taken?
Gosh, it was tough getting people to talk to us because they were petrified. And, you know, Iraq, it works on trust, and it works on who you know and your network of connections. And we had such brave, amazing people helping us that were desperate for this story to get out. And that includes some quite vocal Sunni MPs. And so you're kind of sent along this chain of trust where your word is your bond. And if you come along this chain, you will be introduced to people. And you let them know that their safety is number one priority. So we were very careful not to leave electronic trails. We were very careful to meet people in safe houses, in safe places, to make sure no one was being followed. And also, of course, to never film anybody's face. So even if our footage was confiscated, there would be no faces on our cards.
Tangential to the story, along the way, you had an opportunity to enter some of the tunnels that ISIS has dug. How extensive is their network of tunnels, and how did they use them?
Well, this one tunnel that we saw, it was over a kilometre long. I mean, they run for kilometres, and they're really quite extraordinary. You know, it's not just a tunnel that it looks like, you know, somebody's bored with their hands and a shovel. They're very sophisticated tunnels, kind of nice concrete finishes. And they're terrifying for the army and for the Shia militia, because this is how ISIS have been fighting as well. They pop up out of these tunnels, and nobody knows where these tunnels pop up. And sometimes they pop up in people's homes. They bore tunnels into people's homes, and sometimes it's in the middle of bases. And it's been quite frightening that the Shia militiamen were telling us that one of the aspects that they found most frightening in the fighting were these tunnels, not knowing where these ISIS fighters were going to pop up next.
Once the fight against ISIS is over, do you think the Iranians will leave Iraq?
No, I don't think the Iranians will leave Iraq. I think this is the big question, what happens once the fight against ISIS is over. I think with Mosul, what we're seeing is all the different groups are kind of jockeying for territory and for position and for power. And once ISIS is finished, this is when it's going to be a kind of a grab for territory and power. Certainly the Iranians will absolutely not leave. They have a long history of involvement with Iraq, and they are going to make sure that they keep this corridor that runs from Iran all the way through Syria open, and that it's a Shia corridor for them.
Is it likely there'll be a civil war?
I think some would argue that there is already a civil war. I think what I really learned from my investigation, from making this film, is that the problem will not be over just from beating ISIS. The problem will be far from over from beating ISIS, because you have to go deep. And the problem really is that Sunnis do not feel that they have a stake in Iraq's government and Iraq's future. And until you bring Sunnis into the fold, until you fulfill promises that were made to Sunnis during the Awakening campaign when the Americans were involved, and Sunnis turned against, you know, powerful sheikhs turned against al-Qaeda because they were promised a piece of the political pie, until these promises are fulfilled, people were telling us on the ground in no uncertain terms, there will be another Sunni insurgency.
Ramita Navai, her frontline report, Iraq Uncovered, premieres tonight on PBS stations and online at 10 p.m. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you, even though your report is quite shocking at times and very disturbing.
It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for having me.